between today's talk and earlier talks is that we're going to see how the exponents calculated for using SLE calculated for percolation can come in handy for a particular problem about percolation. We're going to introduce a dynamical version of percolation and show how the information about static percolation comes in handy when doing the analysis of dynamic percolation. This is the model we discussed about percolation, and we will stick to it today. You have a hexagonal mesh, and each hexagon is white with probability 1/2 independently. This is static percolation. In the dynamic version of percolation, you have the same picture, it's only evolving in time. The way it's evolving in time is that each hexagon has a Poisson clock attached to it, which rings at rate one each independently. Each hexagon flips from white to black or from black to white. The basic question one asks about static percolation, well, from the mathematical point of view, is are there infinite clusters? And as I mentioned in the first talk, we have an answer for that in two dimensions. For static percolation, Harris proved in 1960 that there is no infinite cluster when p equals 1/2. And Keston proves in 1980 that there is if we increase p. For dynamic percolation, what do we ask? Well, if we fix some particular time, at that particular time, the percolation configuration is the same as static configuration. And therefore, at most typical times, there will be no infinite cluster by Harris's theorem. And the basic question that differentiates dynamic percolation from static percolation is that we can ask, well, are there exceptional times? Are there some very special times at which there is an infinite cluster, though the typical time doesn't have an infinite cluster? You can, for comparison, you can think about a one-dimensional process, Brownian motion, for example. If you look at Brownian motion, say we have Brownian motions on the circle started at a random point on the circle, and you can ask, well, is it at the point one? I mean, I'm thinking of the circle as being in the imaginary, in the complex plane. So you fix some point on the circle and ask, well, is it at that point? Well, at most times it won't be at that point. Almost every time it won't be at that point, but there certainly are exceptional times where it is at that point. And we would like to ask, you know, our infinite dimensional system, which is percolation, does it visit this special set of times where of configurations which have infinite clusters? We'll first put this question in a more general context to explain what is already known about this. So if we fix some infinite graph, we can consider site percolation on the graph, namely each vertex, each site, we flip a coin to decide whether the site is going to be open or closed, and then we look at the connected component of open site. And in this context, there's always a critical P sub C, PC, which is the least p, where there is positive probability for having an infinite cluster. And I mean, positive probability for the origin being in the infinite cluster. If we have any graph, we can pick one vertex and call that vertex the origin. The answer would not depend on our choice of the origin, provided the graph is connected, which we will generally assume. Hagström, Peres, and Steiff in 97 introduced the concept of dynamical percolation, and they proved the following result. They proved that if P is above PC, well, we're in the setting of an arbitrary infinite graph, and if P is above PC, then there are no exceptional times. Namely, for every fixed time, there is an infinite cluster, and it's true that for all times, there is an infinite cluster with probability 1. So the probability that at all times there is an infinite cluster is 1. Below PC also there are no exceptional times. The probability that there is some time with an infinite cluster is 0. So nothing special occurs below PC, nothing special occurs above PC. And they were also interested what happens at PC, when P equals PC. Well, for ZD, when D is larger than 18, they showed that, again, there are no exceptional times. There are no infinite cluster at PC. And they have constructed some non-regular trees that do have exceptional times. So there certainly are some graphs that have exceptional times. And you can basically build a tree that is whose critical value is, say, 1/2, but it's pretty close to being to percolating at 1/2, and there will be exceptional times. And they did a lot of analysis about what happens to dynamic percolation on trees. For example, calculating the or estimating the dimension of the set of exceptional times. What I want to describe today is joint work with Jeff Steiff. We've shown that particular model of percolation that we've seen before with the hexagons, or we can, it's equivalently site percolation on the triangular grid, there are exceptional times at PC. And this is the only transitive graph for which it is known that there are exceptional times at PC. So it's kind of a special phenomena that we didn't have a handle on before. In particular, the regular tree, the three regular tree doesn't have exceptional times. Okay, we will discuss the proof of this theorem, partly because I think the ingredients of the proof are interesting, and there are many open problems related to improving various aspects of the proof. So the zeroth idea in the proof is that we, instead of getting all the way to infinity, we'll ask just to get to distance r. We will look at I sub r, the set of times in 0, 1, where the origin is connected to distance r away. And what we will show is that the probability that for every r, I sub r is non-empty, that's positive. Namely, well, this is by elementary measure theory, this is the same as the infimum over r. of the probability that I sub R is non-empty. Well, the probability that I sub R is non-empty, that's clearly positive, but it's not clear that the infimum over R will be positive. And that is the point here, that that even when you infimize over R, that stays positive. Namely, these statements are equivalent to saying that with positive probability, the cluster of the origin is unbounded when t is between 0 and 1. So it's the size of the cluster of the origin evolves in time. Well, it stays constant for brief periods and then changes a little bit and so on. And this statement is equivalent to saying that it's unbounded, that the probability it's unbounded is positive. And then going from this fact to the fact that there is an infinite cluster is just involves a simple compactness argument that's just slightly more complicated than the most naive one you can think of. If you're a probabilist, then you know what is the proof idea one going to be. It's going to be to use the second moment argument, because that's what probabilists usually do. And if you're not a probabilist, well, this is a good time to see what probabilists do. I sub R is the set of times in which you have connection to distance R from the origin, and mu of that is just the Lebesgue measure of this set of times. And you take, well, this is a random variable, mu of IR. It's a measure of a random set, it's a random variable. And you can take the second moment divided by the first moment squared, and we will show that the supremum over R of this quantity is finite. This quantity is always at least 1. You use Cauchy-Schwarz. See, the probability, this is an instance of Cauchy-Schwarz. The probability that mu is positive times the expectation of the measure squared is greater or equal to, by Cauchy-Schwarz, to the first moment squared, and therefore when you divide by this, if you prove that this divided by this is bounded away from zero, you get that this is bounded away from zero, which is the conclusion we needed on the previous slide, and this divided by this is bounded away from zero is the same as the reciprocal bounded from infinity. So all we need to do is to prove this, show the second moment divided by the first moment squared is bounded. And let's give a more concrete view of what the second moment means. So mu of IR, this is a random variable, the measure of the set of times in which we're connected to distance R, it's just, you know, by Fubini, the integral from 0 to 1 of the indicator function for t being this time where we're connected to distance R. And therefore, the second moment, the expectation of mu IR squared is... we can take the expectation of the double integral over dt ds of 1 of t and IR, 1 s and IR, and then we can push the expectation into the integration and get this expression for the second moment. So it's the double integral of the probability that t and s are both times at which you can get to distance R. By the way, feel free to stop me with questions. Well, a little bit more intimate today than the first talk, so please don't hesitate to interrupt if there's anything unclear. Now, if you think about this, remember, we want to bound this quantity by the first moment squared. And when you try to, if you think about the dependence of this integral on t, you can see that, or rather on SA, it's very easy to see by translation invariance in time, stationarity, that this double integral doesn't depend on S up to a constant. So you can take practically S equals to zero. There is no... If you give or take a constant, you might as well take S equals to zero. When S is some other value, the inner integrand is comparable to that. That is straightforward to see. And therefore, it's enough to show that the integral from 0 to 1 of the probability that 0 and t are times at which we get to distance r is bounded by a constant times the probability that 0 gets to distance r. This is the first moment, and then we have to square it. Okay, so this brings us to a more general situation where we're interested in expressions of the form, the expectation of f evaluated at omega 0 times f evaluated at omega t. Well, omega t is the configuration in time, at time t, and f is a function of a static configuration. So here, the appropriate f is the indicator function for t being in IR. And here we have the inner product of... before we integrate, the integrand here is just an instance of the expectation of f at time at omega 0 times f at omega t. And then we'll have to later integrate over t. So we're interested in expressions of this form. And we can rewrite this. We can first pretend that we know what omega 0 is. So we condition on omega 0. And then we have f of omega 0 times the conditioned expectation of f omega t given omega 0. And then we take expectation over that. So that's equivalent to that. And that brings us to the situation where we consider the Markov operator. This capital T sub t is what's called the Markov operator. And its meaning is as follows. You know, given the state now, what do we expect the value of f to be in t steps? And that's going to be a function of the state now, and this function is denoted by capital T sub T of F. So this is written here. Capital T sub T of F evaluated at omega is our expected value of F given that currently the position is we are at omega. So this is kind of a form that we're looking at when we try to calculate or estimate this quantity here. And so we want to understand this Markov operator better. In fact, it's easy to diagonalize this operator. If you take U sub V, V is now a hexagon or a site, U sub V of omega, you take it to be 1 if V is open and minus 1 if V is closed. That's a particular function of a static configuration. Then it's easy to see that the Markov operator applied to U sub V is just e to the minus t times U sub V. Why? Well, see, the state flips at rate... e to the, its rate at exponential rate. So after, we can think of it slightly differently, that at twice the rate it re-randomizes instead of flipping. And so when the clock at that site ticks, we lose, the expectation becomes zero, and then the probability that it won't tick in t seconds is e to the minus t, because it's exponential clock of rate 1. Well, so it's nice we found some eigenfunctions for this operator, but it's not yet an orthonormal basis, but we easily get an orthonormal basis, because if we take some set of vertices here and we multiply the u sub v over v and s, and we call that u sub capital S, where S is a set of sites, then by independence on different sites, it's easy to see that T sub T of U sub S is just the product of T sub C, T of the U sub V, so it's equal to E to the minus T times the cardinality of S times U sub S. So now we've diagonalized our operator, and if F depends on finitely many vertices, then you can write F of omega is equal to the sum over S subset of V of its Fourier expansion with respect to this orthonormal basis, namely the coefficient of U sub S is going to be just the inner product of F with U sub S. So this is the standard Fourier setup. And then when we have an expression like this, which is the sort of expression that we want to estimate, all we have to do is we expand the F in the Fourier basis. So we expand both of these Fs, and we get a double sum, where we have one sum is over S and the other is over S prime. And then when we get, we'll get, so each sum looks like that, but we apply the operator, well, we have this expression, we apply the operator to that, so that gives us e to the minus cardinality of S times T. And then we take inner product with a similar expression without the e to the minus t cardinality of S, but because these are orthonormal bases, only the sum ends with the same S contribute to anything, the rest are zero, and this is what we get. We get that the expectation of F inner product with the Markov operator at time t applied to F is just the sum over S of the Fourier coefficient of S squared, of F at S squared, times e to the minus t cardinality of S. So, what do we learn from that? Well, the correlation between F at time zero and F at time t depends on the behavior of the Fourier coefficients of F. Those Fourier coefficients which are high, namely, cardinality S is high, they die quickly, they decay very rapidly when T is large. And those which were cardinality of S is small, they decay very slowly. It takes a long time till this thing becomes small. So to say that something is sensitive to, you know, after a little bit of time, we lose correlation with it. It becomes uncorrelated with what it was to begin with. It's just saying that the Fourier coefficients are mostly on large frequencies. This is helpful to explain what I just said, because you can arrange the sum according to the cardinality of S. So you sum over K e to the minus TK, and then sum over S of cardinality K. So these things will have to be small when S is small in order to have a quick decay of this quantity in T. This is related to the question of noise sensitivity. The Markov operator is basically a noise operator in this case, because if we wait T units of time, the net effect of the dynamics here is just that we randomly pick a set of sites and change their status, and the sites are picked independently with uniform probability, and that's a version of noise. So in an older paper with Benjamini and Kalai, we looked at precisely this question about percolation, and we showed that when Fn is the indicator function for crossing in an n by n square percolation, then you know that for all positive t, so t is now fixed, this is the noise, and you compare the inner product of Fn with t sub t of Fn with the expectation squared, and you find that as n goes to infinity, this quantity tends to zero. What does that mean? That means that basically, it means if n is large and you're looking at an n by n configuration, percolation configuration, but the percolation configuration has some noise in it. There's some slight errors here and there which are independent, identically distributed. Then you cannot make a guess whether there's any educated guess whether there's a crossing or not in the version of percolation which doesn't have any noise. That is in the case where the system is large and the noise stays constant. So if 1% of the sites you're looking at happen to have the wrong label on them, you cannot make any educated guess as to whether there is a crossing or not. And that is equivalent to statements about the Fourier coefficient. So if K is fixed, I mean, it's equivalent by the previous slide. If K is fixed, then the total weight of the Fourier coefficient at level K tends to zero as n tends to infinity, as the system size grows. And another version of this is that this T sub T of Fn tends to a constant function, namely the variance of this function goes to zero with n. Now, what we need in order to... we're interested in... well, in the current project, we're interested in these quantities here. But after we estimate this, we're going to have to integrate this over T. And statements that hold for T fixed will not be good enough, because we will have to look at T that is also very, very close to zero. And so this result is not good enough for our current goals here. There was a conjecture in this BKS paper that, in fact, you can strengthen the result and take, instead of the Markov, instead of the noise being constant as n grows, you can take the noise going to zero as n grows at this kind of rate, like n to the minus epsilon, and still you would have the same result. At the time, we weren't able to prove this, But now we can prove it for this squared and for the triangular grid, because we just had to have such a result to prove the existence of exceptional times. And this is the statement about the Fourier coefficients that comes in handy. It's the question of estimating the Fourier coefficients of these Boolean functions comes up, you know, in many applications, and having tools to estimate them, well, these tools are few, and having them is something quite useful. And here's the theorem that we have, and we're pretty happy with it, but it's not optimal. Okay, let me first tell you what the theorem is. Well, we had to have some way of estimating the weights of the Fourier coefficients at level k, the sum of the Fourier coefficients at level k squared. And the estimate is in terms of what a randomized algorithm does. So suppose that there is a randomized algorithm for calculating a function f, and here I'm just assuming that it's a real-valued function on the space of minus one, one valued, when on the product of Boolean variables, where the background measure is the uniform measure. So suppose that there is a randomized algorithm for calculating f that examines each bit with probability at most delta, then the sum of the Fourier coefficients at level k is at most k times delta times the norm of f squared. And here k can be any integer except zero. This is not true for k equals zero. Okay, that's a good question. What does a randomized algorithm mean? Well, there are two sources of randomness here. One source of randomness is that the input bits themselves have random values, and that's one source of randomness. But for this theorem to have any meaning, it's also necessary that the algorithm itself has some arbitrary source of randomness, private randomness. It can, you know, before it starts to ask any questions, it flips some private coins. And the randomness is this. Probability comes in when we calculate delta, and this probability is in the big space where we also consider the randomness of the algorithm. Well, what does the algorithm do? It flips some coins, and then it says, okay, tell me the 100th bit. Is it a 0 or a 1? And then I say it's 0. And then based on this answer, the algorithm say, okay, now give me the millionth and 2 bit. And then I tell the algorithm what that bit is, and so on, until the algorithm says, aha, I know the answer. F is equal to pi over 3. And that's how the algorithm runs.
What's an exact answer from the algorithm, or only approximate?
Okay, in this version of the theorem, you want an exact answer, but there's a different version which gives an approximate answer, and then on the right-hand side you will have this term plus another term which has to do with how imprecise the answer is. So there is also a version for approximate answers. And approximate can be in two senses. One is that there can be some chance for an error, and the approximation is what is the chance for an error, and the other sense is that it gives close to the correct answer, but not exactly the correct answer. Well, we don't think that this inequality is tight. We think that there should be something, some other function of k here should be the sharpest inequality. And it will be very useful to know what that function is. Maybe something constant times square root of k is, I think, the best. Well, it can't be better than square root of k by examples as we know, at least in general. Okay, so in order to use, so this theorem will estimate the Fourier coefficients at level k, which will then be necessary in order to calculate the second moment via this inner product that we have of the function at time 0 times the function at time t. But in order to make any use of this, we have to estimate delta. And let me tell you how that works for percolation. So first, let's think of a simpler problem than the one that will actually be really useful for our primary need, is that we want to have a crossing from the right-hand side to the left-hand side in this grid. And say we want to think of an algorithm that gives the answer with delta small. Well, first we can just think of a more modest goal. Let's find an algorithm that gives the answer without looking at most of the bits. So just looking at a small expected number of bits, right? We will need an algorithm that for every particular bit has small probability to be looked at. But let's first ask for an algorithm that, you know, for most bits it looks at them with small probability. And then we can just follow the interface in that case. We start at this corner and we follow the interface and we see that we've seen this before in my second talk yesterday, that if this interface hits the top, then there is no crossing in white from left to right. And if it hits the left before the top, then there is a crossing from left to right. Now, in particular, we have to modify this algorithm. This algorithm is not good for the theorem as stated, because to follow the interface, you have to either first look at this hexagon or first look at that hexagon, and then these two hexagons will have delta that is not going to zero with the size of the system, so that's bad. I don't want to say much about how you fix that. I'll just give you the main idea. The main idea is the algorithm picks a point on this edge uniformly at random, say this point, and then looks at two problems. One is the crossing from the part of the edge above this point to the left-hand side, follows an interface to decide that, and then asks, well, is there a path from below this point to the left-hand side? Is there follows the interface for that? So, because this point is random, the interface starts at a random point, and therefore there is no particular hexagon which we are sure to look at. And so the only randomness in the algorithm is in picking this initial point. And it's clear that if there is no crossing above the point and there is no crossing below the point, then there is not going to be any crossing. So that issue is not too hard to handle. Now the delta, remember, the delta is the probability of the hexagon most likely to be visited by the algorithm. So let's ignore those hexagons near the corners here because we're going to use that trick to avoid them. Let's look at two types of hexagons. If there's a hexagon near the middle, what is the chance that that this interface will go by that hexagon, and therefore the algorithm will have to look at the hexagon? Well, in order for this to happen, you have to have, see, that the interface has a white, it's followed by white hexagons on the right-hand side and black hexagons on the left-hand side. So this hexagon here has to be connected to this boundary in a white path and has to be also connected to the boundary in some black path. And the probability that this event happens is denoted by this first term there, alpha sub 2 of 0 n, where 0 means we start at distance 0 and we want to get away to distance n, and the 2 means that we have to have two crossings of two different colors. So that's what happens for a hexagon in the center. There are other hexagons we need to worry about. Another type of hexagon is a hexagon that lives here. Well, this hexagon, the situation is similar, only this hexagon is going to clearly have a crossing to this edge in black because it's already adjacent to that edge. However, it still needs to have a white crossing. But that white crossing is restricted to a half plane. It's not in a full plane. And therefore, the probability that such a thing will happen is denoted in alpha plus 0 comma n, where n is the distance the crossing has to go, and plus reminds us that we have to stay in a half plane. And these quantities here were calculated for this percolation model via SLE. So this is, you know, part of work with Lawler and Werner, and based on Smirnov's theorem and the Smirnov-Werner paper discussing the exponents. And in fact, these two terms, well, I neglected to mention that there are some intermediate cases where the hexagon is not adjacent to the edge but is not precisely in the center. But it's easy to see that they are dominated by one of the two. Let me not go into that. These are the two extreme cases. And it's based on the calculation of the exponents, this one is actually smaller than that one. So this one actually is the one that dominates. And you get, and this quantity is in fact, this quantity is n to the minus 5 over 4 plus little o of 1. And that's what you get for delta here. However, this is not optimal. Based on simulations that are motivated by a paper with Paris, Sheffield, and Wilson, there are algorithms that in practice answer this question much faster with a smaller delta, but we have no proof that they actually work faster. So, yes? The second one is a limit of this one? Well, these are two extreme cases from a family as the hexagon moves between them. And in practice, when you're doing this, you have to consider all the possible hexagons in between. But I've just decided to skip that part and discuss the two extreme cases because those are in between. The answer turns out to be in between as well. Now, for us, this question will be less relevant than the question of deciding the analogous question for an annulus. So we will have to ask, now the function will be, is there a crossing from some given radius little r to some given radius big R? And we will... There is a similar interface that is a little bit more complicated than in the simply connected case. But the analysis is aside from the complication, the analysis is similar, and again, the delta turns out to be this product. So, in order to examine this particular hexagon here, well, the hexagons near the center are those most likely to be examined. Those further away, you start the interface from the outer boundary, so you're more likely to visit a hexagon on the outer boundary because, well, you're less likely, but there are two competing tendencies. In the first part, you're more likely to visit it because you start at the outer boundary and you may never even get inside. On the other hand, there are many more out there than inside, and since there are fewer, if you do get inside, you're more likely to visit anyone. And it turns out that the most likely to be visited is some hexagon close to the inner circle. In order to visit it, first you have to get to roughly that radius, and the probability for that is essentially the probability of a crossing between 2R and capital R. And then you have to actually, the interface has to pass through there, which is, as before, estimated by this quantity. So first you have to get to approximately radius R, and then you have to visit that particular hexagon, and that's going to be the estimate for delta. And again, this we've seen before, and this one is also estimable from using SLE techniques. And then we can put this whole story together. The probability to get to distance r at time 0 and at time t. Well, you have to do a cutoff here. So you choose some. You want to get from 0 to r. And you pick some parameter, little r. Well, little r will tend out to be a function of t. And you say, well, I will estimate it in as follows. Well, I have to get between, say this is 2r. I have to get between this radius and capital R, both at time 0 and at time t. And over here, I also have to do that, but up to radius r, I will say, okay, I cannot estimate the correlation between them any better than just saying that I have to have a crossing in one of them. So the probability you have a crossing from distance 0 to distance r in time 0 and at time t is at most, on the one hand, the probability that you have a crossing from radius 0 to radius r times the probability that you have a crossing from 2r to capital R at time 0 and at time t. So in the inner circle, you forget about time t because it's not going to help you any. Up to the radius r, the correlation is too big and you don't hope to get any gain there. And then this probability you estimate with this Fourier expansion method. So it's going to be the sum over k e to the minus kt times the sum of the Fourier coefficient squared, Fourier coefficients of frequency k. And then separately, you need to, the k equals 0 case is not covered by the theorem. The k equals 0 case is you have only the Fourier coefficient of the empty set, which is the same squared, which is the same as the expectation of the function. And then for the other Fourier coefficients, you use the theorem and you use the estimate for delta, and this is what you get. So you get an estimate in terms of these various alpha functions. And what you have to see that this is less than or equal to the square of alpha 0 capital R, and you can do that. I'm not going to do the calculation now. It is somewhat interesting, but we don't have time for that. Let me mention that the argument almost applies to z squared, where you don't have the exponents. There's an inequality that this alpha 2 of little r capital R is at most alpha r capital R squared. This is follows from the FKG inequality or the BK inequality. And if we had a slight improvement of that, where the right-hand side is multiplied by little r over r to the epsilon, which is definitely believed to be true, then that would be enough to make the z-squared case also work, to the bond percolation on z-squared work. Another way to make the argument work for the square grid is to improve the estimate of delta, get a better algorithm and prove that it is better, or improve the Fourier theorem. Remember, the Fourier theorem was probably not sharp, and if you can get any significant improvement to that theorem, you will be able to cover that case. And you can calculate the exponent for the squared. That would do it as well. Let me skip that. Let me mention, I don't have time to prove the Fourier theorem. Let me tell you a little bit about further results. The set of exceptional times has Hausdorff dimension between 1/6 and 31 over 36. We don't know where it is, though probably this is the correct answer. There are no exceptional times where there exist two infinite clusters. If you consider a wedge in the plane where the angle is theta, then we have similarly, we have estimates for how theta has to be in order to have k different infinite clusters at some exceptional times, and bounds both for existence and for non-existence, and we have the estimates for the Hausdorff dimension. Basically, if you want to have k infinite clusters, to have some exceptional time when there are k infinite clusters, you have to have theta growing at least quadratically in k. That's both the lower bound and the upper bound are quadratic in k, and the coefficient is different. Similarly, you can think of cones where you take an angle theta and you glue these two segments together to make a cone angle of theta. Well, we worked this out only when theta was a multiple of pi over 6, because then it's compatible with the lattice. But it should be true in greater generality. And then we have similar results for when there are exceptional times and what the Hausdorff dimension. The point here is to see that this property of having exceptional times is a very delicate property. I mean, the most percolation properties, they don't change if you go from a full plane to a wedge of any given angle. And just the fact that the exceptional times, they do change, the existence or non-existence, says that, you know, this is a very sensitive quantity to look at. And I'll finish with a bunch of open problems. We want to, as I mentioned, improve the estimates for delta. Improving the Fourier theorem, I'm sure, will be very useful in many other situations that may, you know, even seem unrelated. These Fourier coefficients are extremely important. And understanding the Fourier coefficients of percolation in particular is a problem that I'm fascinated with. And so the z-squared case is certainly interesting. Getting the correct Hausdorff dimension would be interesting. And understanding the space-time scaling limit is seems also like a fascinating question. And that's it. That's the end of my talks. Thank you very much for coming and listening to me.